to the bar of this court. Congratulations. You may be seated. Mr. Squires, do you have any other business before the court before we proceed to oral argument? Very well, then. First, before we begin, I would like to note that, unfortunately, Judge Sparks cannot be with us here today. However, he will be participating on the record. Our first case, United States versus Flores. Mr. Spinner, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, sir.
And Lieutenant Fisher, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well, then. Mr. Spinner, please proceed.
Yes, sir. May it please the court, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. Today I am appearing on behalf of my client, Stephen Flores. My co-counsel is Lieutenant Commander Maggie Kane Cruz, recently promoted to Lieutenant Commander. Today, because of the limits of time and the issues involved in this case, I'm going to focus in great part on one of the questions that exist, and that has to do with whether or not the bond hearing that was held in the state of Georgia, at that hearing, the right under the Sixth Amendment attached, right to counsel. And so that's one part of my focus. Another part of my focus is that I discovered that I had some issues where I had failed to cite evidence in the joint appendix. And first of all, on page 10 of our brief, I miscited joint appendix page 93, and it should be 245.
Okay, thank you.
Additionally, on page 14, footnote 60, in addition to the reference to pages 371 and 73, in the joint appendix, also 260 and 261 to 261. And I'll address these as I proceed. As I reflected on the issue as it was granted in this case, and I've been reflecting on it a lot the last 2 days in preparation for this argument, the key issue, as I see it, narrows down to this. Where there is an overlapping joint investigation conducted by two sovereigns, and in this case, the state of Georgia and the Navy, from the beginning of an investigation, can the dual sovereignty doctrine be applied under the Sixth Amendment? So we did not make that focus in the issue that was granted. We focused on just, does the dual sovereignty apply to military law? And that this court has not specifically ruled on that issue. The primary case that we relied on is Redbird. And in Redbird, U.S. versus Redbird, there's a significant parallel between what happened there and what happened in this case. In Redbird, it was a tribal case and tribal court, but the key point from that case was the aspect of being a joint investigation. There are a lot of federal appellate courts cited by both sides. We only had two that we really focused on, United States versus Mills and United States versus Redbird. And the government cited a number of additional cases. But why Redbird is so important is because of the parallels and the facts in the cases and how it was clearly a joint investigation between the tribal court or the tribal investigators and the federal investigators in Redbird.
Mr. Spinner, when you're talking about cases, I'm interested in talking to you about a case that was cited on page 18 of the CCA opinion of Montejo versus Louisiana. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that, quote, doctrines ensuring voluntariness of a Fifth Amendment waiver simultaneously ensure the voluntariness of a Sixth Amendment waiver, end quote. So if this court were to simply focus on the Fifth Amendment waiver and conclude that your client had, in fact, waived under the Fifth Amendment, do we need to even address the Sixth Amendment in light of the Supreme Court decision?
As you can imagine, my co-counsel and I have discussed that to a great extent. We, I think, somehow overlooked the significance of Montejo versus Louisiana when we wrote our brief. And, in fact, it was Redbird relied on Michigan versus Jackson, and the fact that under Michigan versus Jackson, there was a basically a waiver would not be applicable to an interview that occurred after the right to counsel attached. So in anticipation of this question, came sooner than I thought, we would ask the right to resubmit or request a reconsideration of the denial of the grant on our Fifth Amendment issue. I guess
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Okay, we raised the Fifth Amendment issue.
Correct.
That this was, that the interview in question in this case was a violation of the Fifth Amendment. And it was the government initiated the interrogation. And, in fact, they went 30 minutes into the interview where they even advised our client of his rights and then obtained the waiver, which the government relies on. And so where I sit right now on that issue is, did the court – why did the court grant on this issue if it didn't grant on the Fifth Amendment issue? Because if the court already determined that there was no issue under the Fifth Amendment, this honorable court, and Montejo v. Louisiana is a 2009 case, then it almost begs the question, why are we here? So I recognize the question, and I would like an opportunity to go back and revisit our supplement to the petition for grant of review where we sought review for that issue.
I think the phrase that applies to that is highly irregular.
Yes.
You've had an opportunity to – we have presented the issue. You have had an opportunity to brief it, and if this court decides that we can decide this issue based on what's been presented to us, that is what we would do. So do you wish to address – substantively, Montejo?
Well, I...
within the context of
I
this
case?
I don't
dispute Montejo. And even in Redbird, after Redbird applied the, or said the dual sovereignty doctrine does not apply, then they relied on Michigan versus Jackson to say, well, the statement, the incriminating statement that was obtained because of the broad scope of Michigan versus Jackson that they had to reverse. So I guess I did not – it's – when you're preparing for an oral argument, a lot of things come into focus that at the time you were writing your brief, you may have overlooked, or you get so maybe focused on just the each individual issue without looking at, wait a minute, this Fifth Amendment issue carries over or spills over into the Sixth Amendment issue. And so we just did not see that significance, and I think that's where I've done a lot of research on that because I wanted to see, well, does a cleansing advisement have to go beyond – for the Sixth Amendment issue violation, does it have to go beyond the cleansing in a Fifth Amendment issue? And I couldn't find any case law that made that distinction.
So
Judge Johnson?
Thank you, Chief. So, counsel, because that leads into my question then. You asserted that government reinitiated the interrogation.
Yes.
How, if at all, then, do you distinguish what your client said, so what's next, from the statement that was made in Oregon v. Bradshaw?
Well, again, the challenge for me right now is we briefed that in our supplement. Mm-hmm. I did not prepare for that question for this issue because we saw that as the issue that the court did not grant review on. My focus was on the dual sovereignty doctrine, which is what this court granted on. So, yes, I've been practicing before this court for 40 years, and I have not – ever made a request to rebrief or rewrite a supplement to focus on that very question. I think we addressed that in our written supplement. That's my recollection. I just didn't prepare to come argue that point today.
But Mr. Spinner, can we return to the dual sovereign doctrine? And the government's position, as I understand it, is that under the Sixth Amendment, it's offense-specific, not investigation-specific, that the Sixth Amendment is to be interpreted, the word offense in the Sixth Amendment is to be interpreted the same way as in the Fifth Amendment. And in the Fifth Amendment, it's not the same offense if you have different sovereigns.
Right.
And so they say those three steps make this an easy case. But it sounds like your point is that, well, that may be true, never decided yet in the military, it may be true, but not in the case of a joint investigation. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that's why a lot of the circuit court cases referenced by the government, they did not have those joint investigations.
What makes this, what's the test for what is a joint investigation and why is this a joint investigation?
Well first of all, in her opinion, the judge is ruling in this case, and I'm reading specifically Joint Appendix 427. In the footnote there, footnote 2, it says, this court finds that at the time Detective Cruz's interrogation of MT-1 Flores, St. Mary's Police Department was engaged in a separate investigation and NCIS was only involved as a limited assist. It was not a joint or merged investigation. And then it cites Agent Michaela Batten testified on 2 March, the NCIS opened a limited assist investigation against MT-1 Flores on 19 July 22. And then it carries over into just an, so she basically says it's not a joint investigation, and I think her finding of fact is clearly erroneous. And that goes back to the footnote that I gave you an additional page on a moment ago. The two special agents that testified on whether this was a joint investigation both testified under oath that it was a joint investigation. And I don't know why the trial judge put this in a footnote and did not directly address the testimony of those two witnesses. A moment ago I referred to, let me get my pages.
Well, counsel, I'm looking at JA 369 and 370.
Right.
Is that what you're referencing? It's the examination, it's a redirect examination of one of the special agents, and they were specifically asked about whether it was a joint investigation, how a joint investigation is determined, and then at one point it became joint. Are those the two pages, JA 369, 370? Okay.
I think, and then I read to the court, and I'm thumbing through my notes here, but there were two agents that testified, and both of them said it became a joint investigation. In fact, the lead agent in the case basically said that the arrest, I think, was 19 July 2022, and the NCIS was there, and actually an NCIS agent, when my client invoked his rights, I think two times, and then they had the NCIS agent talk to him, and this is the 19th of July, so the NCIS was in part of it right away. So there was limited assistance on the 19th of July, but the other agent testified that the joint part of the investigation, and became a full-fledged joint investigation, occurred on the next day, 20 July, and ran up to and through when the state of Georgia released the case to the Navy.
Counsel, how would that conclusion be consistent with the Supreme Court's holding in Texas versus Cobb?
Well, Texas versus Cobb is not a dual sovereignty case, as I recall.
No, and it seems like that makes it even worse for you. You have the same sovereign, two different police departments from the same sovereign investigating the defendant. And there the court said it was still a separate investigation.
I think they were the same offenses. No, they were not the same offenses.
They were not the same offenses.
Yeah, I'm not saying that they're the same sovereigns. I'm not making that statement. I'm just saying that the – so, for instance, if a Fourth Amendment violation occurs in a state court, then a federal court cannot exploit that Fourth Amendment violation in federal court. So I think the Redbird case is just basically saying you can't exploit this and that Texas v. Cobb really is an applicable situation that they were facing. I'm not saying that the state and the federal government are the same sovereign. And I hadn't thought of it that way, to be clear. But I think my time.
So, well, I'm sorry, did you have a follow-up? Because I just want to make sure. So you just said that although you are arguing it was a joint investigation, you are not arguing that that joint investigation therefore vitiates dual sovereignty.
Well, I'm saying dual sovereignty doesn't apply. And that's what Redbird said. Dual sovereignty doesn't come into play on a joint investigation.
Because it's a joint investigation. Okay. So you are attacking dual sovereignty. If you're saying by virtue of the fact, assuming arguendo, this is a joint investigation, then dual sovereignty does not come into play.
Right.
Okay. I'm just trying to be clear your position.
Right. And I found the other page for the I gave this to you a few minutes ago, but footnote 80 in our or 60 in our brief, at page 14 of our brief. The pages I added were the other agent, pages Joint Appendix 260 and 61. So you basically have two NCIS agents saying this was a joint investigation. And the point being that the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attached at the bond hearing. And I have 5 minutes reserved so I can address any other questions.
Any further questions at this time? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Spinner. Senator Fisher.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Stephanie Fisher, and along with Colonel Ian Pedden, I represent the United States. Appellant's conviction under Article 120B for raping his 9-year-old daughter must be upheld because regardless of whether his Sixth Amendment right to counsel had attached in the state proceeding, it had not attached in the military proceeding under MRE 305C3 at the time of his interview. The dual sovereignty doctrine articulated by the Supreme Court holds that where there are two sovereigns, there are two laws and two offenses, and therefore double jeopardy does not bar prosecutions by separate sovereigns even for the same conduct. The Supreme Court further holds that there is, quote, no constitutional difference between the meaning of the term offense in the context of double jeopardy and of the right to counsel, and that the Sixth Amendment right to counsel is offense-specific and cannot be invoked once for all future prosecutions. As such, the military judge did not err in applying the dual sovereignty doctrine to the Sixth Amendment and finding appellant's right to counsel was not violated. Turning first to current precedent.
So turnabout is fair play. What is the government's position in regard to Montejo versus Louisiana?
Your Honor, if I could briefly flip to my notes on that. I believe in Montejo v. Louisiana, the key distinction there is that first they had already initiated an adversarial proceeding against him. They held the preliminary hearing in that case. And at the time of the interview, he was also already represented by counsel at that moment in time, as they had appointed counsel at his preliminary hearing. So that is just a distinct set of facts from what we have here. So that is why Montejo came out the way it has, but it doesn't have any application to this case before us.
So it's the government's position that Montejo has no application to this case?
Yes, Your Honor, or at least it's distinct.
Because Montejo versus Louisiana seems to be completely dispositive of this case in the government's favor. That's why I'm interested in your concession that it does not apply.
Sure.
I apologize. I misspoke on that. If the issue that you're addressing is MRA 305E3B to say that if he validly reinitiated his Fifth Amendment, validly reinitiated with the NCIS agents and therefore waived his Fifth Amendment, and under Montejo, you waive your Fifth Amendment and Sixth Amendment rights the same way, then yes, I would say that is dispositive. But given that the issue before the court or the issue that was granted is whether the military judge abused her discretion in holding that the dual sovereignty doctrine applies, we are also prepared to address and talk about that issue and think that is an important thing for this court to give guidance on so that important constitutional rights are clarified down the road. So with the court's permission, I'd like to turn to the Federal Circuit Courts of Appeals and how they address the dual sovereignty doctrine in the Sixth Amendment context. So nearly every circuit court of appeals, with the exception of the Eighth Circuit and Redbird, has held that the Supreme Court in Cobb incorporated its double jeopardy jurisprudence, including the dual sovereignty doctrine, into its Sixth Amendment right to counsel jurisprudence. And essentially that jurisprudence in Cobb is simply that if an offense is separate for the purposes of double jeopardy, then that offense is also separate for the purposes of when the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attaches. So in each offense, the Sixth Amendment is going to attach separately. And so here, regardless of whether the state of Georgia had initiated adversarial proceedings, which is our position they had not, that dual sovereignty doctrine would still apply. And the only reason that the Eighth Circuit and Redbird chose not to apply that was, first, they were dealing with what they called the unique and limited nature of tribal sovereignty compared to federal sovereignty. And the other, some of the other issues present in Redbird was the federal government did not know about the crimes until the tribal government alerted them. And at the same time, they had both the tribal investigator and the NCIS investigator in the room at the same time during the interview, so that makes it distinguishable. And then the Second Circuit in Mills had originally held that the dual sovereignty doctrine did not apply, but in Warlow they clarified their holding in saying they were going to apply the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in Cobb, and that their holding in Mills was limited to the fact that the evidence that had been introduced in Mills was obtained in violation of the defendant's constitutional rights, and that the dual sovereignty doctrine could not apply to get in otherwise inadmissible evidence.
I'm getting a little bit of an echo, so if you could just slow down just a little bit, because I'm getting like a reverb.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will do that.
Could you please address Mr. Spinner's argument that when you have a joint investigation, the dual sovereignty doctrine doesn't apply, and also the argument that this is in fact a joint investigation?
Yes, Your Honor. 2 points to that. So I will first turn the court's attention to Heath v. Alabama. And in that case, under the dual sovereignty doctrine, the Fifth Amendment did not prohibit two convictions in two different states for the same murder, so the same underlying conduct, despite the convictions resulting from what they call and confirm as a joint investigation and subsequent cooperation in the prosecution. So one state actually had law enforcement from the other state testifying at trial. So under the Supreme Court's precedent, whether or not it's a joint investigation does not vitiate the dual sovereignty doctrine. And in the 11th Circuit in United States v. Hughes, they confirmed the same thing, and they rejected the argument that a joint investigation provides an exception. And then in terms of whether or not this was a joint investigation, there is some evidence in the record that there was initially a joint investigation. What the record does not have is evidence that there was ongoing cooperation or ongoing investigations or sharing of information once jurisdiction was transferred to the military, and certainly not the situation where you had both the state law enforcement and the NCIS agents conducting interviews together or working in tandem. The record does not have any of that evidence. So it is our position that it was not a joint investigation, and even if it continued to be a joint investigation, Heath v. Alabama is dispositive on that issue.
Counsel, is it the government's position that the military judge's statement about it not being a military, is that a conclusion of law or a finding of fact?
That it was not a joint investigation.
That it was not a joint investigation.
I think that would be a finding of fact more so than a conclusion of law, and then the conclusion of law would be how the joint investigation applies to the dual sovereignty doctrine, which is that there is no exception for it under current precedent.
May I please ask again about waiver? You say early on in your brief that this was waived. But then your brief argument is really just about the dual sovereignty. That's just because we only granted on the dual sovereignty argument. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, Your Honor. We did note that the court below found that 305E3B would apply. So since the court did had the issue of whether his Fifth Amendment rights were violated before them, declined to grant that issue and only granted the Sixth Amendment, that it would apply, and he did waive his Sixth Amendment rights if he validly reinitiated. But given that the court, the issue granted was whether the military judge abused her discretion, similar to the CCA, they noted that we're going to go ahead and discuss the dual sovereigns doctrine, discuss whether or not Georgia had initiated an adversarial proceeding, since that's what her ruling hinged on.
Counsel, may I also ask, do we need to address the issue of whether the right to counsel had attached in the Georgia bond hearing? You argue that it had not. Mr. Spinner argues that it did. But do we need to address that if we apply the dual sovereignty doctrine?
No, Your Honor. If you apply the dual sovereignty doctrine to the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, that is dispositive. And then whether or not the right had attached in Georgia does become completely irrelevant to the issue. But I am happy to discuss with this court whether or not there was an adversarial proceeding in Georgia under the Supreme Court's precedent, if that's something you would like to.
And one other question. Mr. Spinner says that we can't really, if we were to conclude that this was an error, that we really couldn't find it to be harmless, even with all the additional evidence, the mother's testimony, the daughter's testimony, the sane nurse's testimony, just because of the powerful force given to admissions by the accused. Those were essentially the arguments made in the reply brief. What's your response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. The United States' position is that this was indeed harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and we are not aware of a case that specifically states that because it was the accused's own statement that it would somehow be treated differently. This court in Swift considered the statement of the accused, and what they were really looking at there is whether the elements could have been proven without the erroneous admission. So for the false official statement, they said his statement that he made was the only evidence of that. But then they upheld all the other charges. And so basically what the court considers with harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, same thing with this court's statement in Moran, is that if you take away the erroneously admitted statement, was it unimportant relation to everything else that was considered? And here we have the testimony of the victim saying that her father did indeed rape her. We have the testimony of the mother who had walked in and found the appellant naked in bed on top of his daughter. We have the DNA evidence that states that his seminal fluid was found in the victim's vaginal vestibule, and the DNA expert testified that it was one of the highest probabilities in her 20-year career that it came from appellant, and they were able to exclude the victim's brother, who was the only other male in the house. We have the Sane's testimony about the injuries that she suffered that you would otherwise not see in a 9-year-old child. And so considering that his statement was only an admission to state that he was naked in bed with his daughter and wasn't even an admission to an element of the crime, it's unimportant in relation to all the other damning evidence in the record.
Also, I had a question about the military judge's conclusion about reinitiation. The military judge goes into a lot of specificity in a ruling about the conversations that appellant and the officers had. And they talked about conditions in the jail and his family and moving to Texas and life in Texas. And then the military judge at the end concludes that these conversations represent a desire on part of the accused to open up a more generalized discussion, right? So she's citing the exact standard. She's getting the law exactly right. But I don't really necessarily see the connection between the general topics that appellant was discussing with the officers and then an intent to have a more generalized discussion about the investigation. What is the government's theory, or maybe you can help fill in some of the gaps here in the military judge's ruling about how we get from your family and moving to Texas and where to go out in San Antonio to discussion about the investigation itself?
Your Honor, I would offer that not having briefed the Fifth Amendment issue to the court, that is something that we would like to offer supplemental briefing on if the court is going to reengage with the Fifth Amendment reinitiation issue. But initially, just from what we argued at the CCA and what we briefed there, was functionally that, you know, he immediately got in the car, immediately started talking. They, you know, did not engage with him, did not really respond to him. He kept going. And then finally, after, you know, just back and forth conversation, they read him his rights. They made sure, they double checked, made sure that, you know, he understood him. They made him read the portions of the waiver out loud. He signed them. And then a while later is when he made the statement that came in. But again, if the court is going to take up the Fifth Amendment issue after declining to grant it, we would request supplemental briefing on that.
In the government's view, what is the best evidence in the record to support that the appellant reinitiated discussions with the officers? Well, is it just the what's next statement because it's so similar to Bradshaw?
Yes, Your Honor. That is essentially largely what the military judge relied on, and we think that is almost a direct correlation to what happened in this instance. And so under the Edwards rule, he validly waived his right to counsel under the Fifth Amendment, and then under Montejo, that is the same way that you would waive your Sixth Amendment right as well. So even if we did not apply dual sovereignty doctrine, then that is also dispositive as well. Pending any further questions, the United States.
Are there any further questions from the bench? Seeing none, you may conclude.
Yes, Your Honor. Pending any further questions, the United States respectfully requests that this court uphold the findings and sentence as adjudged.
Thank you, Lieutenant Fisher. Mr. Spinner.
There's another point in Montejo v. Louisiana that is completely separate from the fact that it overturned Michigan versus Jackson. And 556 U.S. Nope, let me get it right. 557 U.S. 949 at page 960. On that page, it says, on September 10th, Montejo was brought before a judge for what is known in Louisiana as a 72-hour hearing, a preliminary hearing required under state law. Now, the references to the hearing in our case was that it was a bond hearing, and I don't know that there's a distinction between a bond hearing and a preliminary hearing. But it says, although the proceedings were not transcribed, the minute record indicates what transpired. The defendant being charged with first-degree murder, court ordered no bond set in this matter. Further, court ordered the Office of Indigent Defender be appointed to represent the defendant. So it appears that the hearing in which the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attached, as recognized by the Supreme Court, was not an issue in this case. And in fact, they go on to say a few pages later, it is worth emphasizing first what is not in dispute or at stake here. Under our precedents, once the adversary judicial process has been initiated, the Sixth Amendment guarantees the defendant the right to have counsel present at all critical stages of the criminal proceedings. So the government in their brief argued that there was no Supreme Court precedent for essentially a bond hearing to be a preliminary hearing or a critical stage of the proceeding, and yet that's the kind of hearing that took place in Montejo v. Louisiana. So I understood that the reason that that case came into existence was more a result of overturning or reversing or whatever you want to, getting rid of Michigan versus Jackson. But nobody questioned whether or not the right to counsel attached at this Louisiana hearing. And I think that's an important distinction. Going back to the Fifth Amendment issue, I don't know to what extent the court or their clerks or whatever, your clerks, go back and read the motions that were presented at trial. And at Joint Appendix 57 is a very lengthy motion submitted by the defense. It's one of the most comprehensive motions I've ever seen. I commend the attorney that wrote it. And a number of the questions about the whether or not our client reinitiated the interrogation voluntarily, or that's addressed at great length in here, and what the evidence is. And we really didn't develop what appears in the motion, but I think it's very critical if the court is going to go back and make a decision about whether we can reengage on this point. I think you'll find that defense motion very helpful, and then, of course, the arguments at trial. But we do believe that this and if you recall, there was some text or messages sent between the NCIS agent saying he's talking too much and what do we do with the Navy JAG, and they said, hey, just give a cleansing statement. But the agent didn't do it right away. He didn't start out this. So they bring him back to the base. They say, take a shower, do this, that. Now, all this time, he is being confined or held by, he's in custody of the agents. So there never was a break for him from that custody where he could even go consult with an attorney, which he had and which the government knew he had. In those communications between the NCIS agent and the JAG who was advising him, they understood that he had a lawyer. And I think the agent, there's a thing called the Reed technique that nobody has referenced it here or claimed that he was using the Reed technique, but I'm sure the court's familiar with cases that have talked about the Reed technique. And to me, it's clear that the agent didn't want to walk right back in and give him a cleansing statement. And that was the whole point of this session, rapport building session or whatever you want to call it, but that was the whole point. And our position, and it's stated in the motion, is that the cleansing statement should have been attained at the beginning of that 30-minute biographical conversation about his life. So obviously, if you decide that we're wrong or you disagree with us on the application of the dual sovereignty doctrine in this case, then it probably doesn't matter at that point. But if you say it does apply, but it's waived because of this cleansing statement, I would like the opportunity to go back and revisit that. And my time is expired.
Any questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Spinner.
Yes, sir.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:25.
Court stands in recess until 10:25.